Well, hello, everyone, and welcome to the Resilient Leadership Podcast, where everything we talk about is aimed at helping you lead with a greater sense of calm, clarity, and conviction, even in anxious times. And my name is Irvin Nugent. And as always, I'm delighted to welcome and be joined by my co-host and collaborator, Bridget Tyer. Bridget, welcome. How are you doing today?
I'm doing great, Irvin. Thank you so much for asking. You know, before we hit the record button, we were chatting, of course, about the timeliness of this topic that you have chosen. And boy, am I just really excited to dive into it. And it has personal meaning for me, but I think it's going to really resonate with so many of our leaders. So Irvin, what is our topic for
today? You know, likewise, the last month or two, this topic has just come up in coaching and in conversations and in general. So what we're calling the episode today is Leading When Life Hurts, Resilience During Personal Crisis. And I think this is a topic that if it's not touching us today, it more than likely will touch us. And what I mean by, you know, life hurting is, you know, it could be a health scare. It could be the death of someone close. It could be a family upheaval, like divorce, or even just moving and relocating. Or just, you know, we all go through seasons in life, and maybe it's just a season of deep emotional strain. What's obvious, but I think we should say it, is just before we're going through this season. And what makes it so challenging is, of course, you know, that leadership doesn't stop. It continues. The work keeps people moving. People still are looking at you as a leader. You know, we're looking for direction. And so you have to balance this well-being under a different sort of pressure. I just thought it was interesting. You know, I remember looking, researching a little bit about this, and the Harvard Business Review study found that 70% of leaders who have navigated a significant personal crisis when leading. And yet, when they were asked about that, only a small percentage felt equipped to do that. So most people felt that they had a power through it, you know, just hang on there for dear life. And even if it's a great emotional cost to me, I can't let people down. So let's dive into this topic, Bridget, because I think it'll be near and dear to many people who are listening to this podcast. And if it's not you, perhaps this list, it may be you have a friend who is absolutely going through this. You have coached and worked with and journeyed with many leaders, and I'm sure many of them have gone through hard seasons. And I'm just curious, you know, what have you noticed about how leaders typically tend to handle leadership when things get really personally difficult?
Yeah, you know, Irvin, it's interesting that you asked that question and that you're bringing this topic up now, because like you, I have had a number of clients who have been undergoing personal traumas of various sorts. So when I think about how they handle it, I think I'm going to say that the first instinct is to power through it. You know, it's kind of like what you were saying. It's like, look, life goes on. This company goes on. My role goes on. There's work to do. Now I'm just going to maybe bury it is a little bit too strong of a word, but it's sort of like, let me just get on with things and nobody will be the wiser. Or if they know about it, we just won't talk about it. That's what I've noticed. Now, those who do talk about it, I think it is few and far between, and it's brief. I think the main thing of what I've observed is let's move on, and almost an apologetic stance. Right? It's like, I'm sorry, I'm going through this. I mean, they don't say that. That undertone. You know what I mean? What about you?
Yeah, absolutely. That really resonates with me when I think about it. You know, this pushing harder, almost like a frantic staying busy. In a way of distraction, you know, from the pain that they're going through, and maybe just kind of like this belief that I'll outrun it. Whatever's happening, I'll do that. But I always say, you know, that can get you through a week or 2 weeks or a month, but it's just not sustainable. It's not sustainable, I think, for you, and it's not sustainable for the organization. And I think what I've noticed, the ones that do better or leaders that do better, they tend to practice a little bit more honest self-assessment and pace. I think they're able to say, be honest and say, you know what? I have to deal with this. I'm not going to outrun it. I can't ignore it. And pushing harder is just not going to work in the long run. So let's dig in a little deeper then. And I think we always try and do is, because we tend to look at issues from a systems perspective, this is an interesting one because this is a very personal issue, and yet it impacts the wider system. So I'm just curious, Bridget, when you think about this from a systems perspective, you know, what's happening when a leader is maybe going through something very painful or a very stressful personal situation?
Yeah, it's really such a great question, because in a relationship system, what affects one affects all.
Yeah, yeah.
And so when a leader is going through a personal crisis, the entire emotional field, the whole system senses it.
Mm.
There's a felt impact. It's like a ripple, even if nothing is said out loud.
Yeah.
So I think that's so important for us to realize that there isn't any way to avoid the impact on the system of a leader's personal crisis. Yeah. It's just a question of how you manage it.
Yeah.
And so how do you manage it, right? So that's the thing. So I think that, you know, when nothing is said and you're trying to be quiet and outrun it, people fill in the blanks because they sense something. Maybe they've heard bits and pieces. But what they do is, from an anxious place, they fill in whatever is missing. That can raise collective anxiety. So that's one thing. I think, you know, keeping in mind that the team always organizes around the leader for better and for worse. So they're going to organize around the leader's distress that they're picking up on. And when nothing is said, then they may react from an anxious place and overfunction for the leader or underfunction. Roles might drift, you know, connections might fray. And so really at the end of the day, I think it's good to remember that it is the leader's emotional presence that is the anchor.
Yeah.
And I don't want to put more pressure on anybody who's listening and going through a personal crisis and starting to be like, oh my gosh, like on top of that, now I've got to do this. But it really isn't like that. It's just that even limited but steady connection and presence from the leader calms the uncertainty. A little bit of transparency, a little bit of connection goes a long way.
Yeah.
And then when the leader in a personal crisis exercises self-care and takes care of themselves, it regulates the emotional health of the entire system.
Mm.
You know, we always think of taking care of self as kind of like a selfish personal thing that I'll get to it if I can, not recognizing that when we attend to self and care for self, the whole relationship system around us feels it and benefits from it.
Yeah. I love that, because, you know, I think so often we get into this game about, you know, almost like this, I have to either hide it, and we think we're doing a great job, you know, and people either fill the blanks or they feel something. They just know something's off.
Yeah.
Or the second thing is, you know, well, I just can't take the time for myself. But ironically, in taking that time for yourself, you're actually helping the whole system, which I think is a beautiful perspective, because I think so often we get into these games about, I don't have the time to take care of myself. Yeah. I say, no, you do, because actually when you do that, you're actually helping other people. I think that's a lovely way to look at it.
Yeah. And, you know, I always go back to something that you've said before on the podcast,
yeah,
right? Which is the greatest gift that a leader can give their team is a well-regulated nervous system.
Yeah. It's so true.
So do we,
especially in this
so
case.
We are coming back to that.
Yeah,
again,
absolutely.
Right?
Yeah.
Well, so Irvin, let's get practical here and talk about, like, what are some specific things that leaders can actually do to lead through a personal crisis?
Well, I think we've kind of alluded to it, but the first thing I would just say is a little bit of self-honesty around the issue of capacity. Because I think, sure, you know, anyone can do Herculean tasks for 1 week. Mm-hmm. But especially if you're dealing with a crisis that's ongoing, maybe a health scare that's going to take months,
yeah,
or something messy that's going to take months as well, mm-hmm. to really be honest and say, you know what, my capacity is not the same and will not be the same for at least 5 or 6 months.
Mm-hmm.
And just to really, first of all, say that personally, and then also to clarify that and to bring it to the open, that can be very scary. I think most people get surprised by how much support that they receive as well. And I think that goes into the second thing, which is, you know, ask for help before you need it, desperately need it. I think so often when we're trying to rebalance capacity, and if we're just kind of denying that, and then we're waiting until there is a crisis, mm-hmm. it's just adding, like we've just talked about, adding more anxiety to the system. So really, if we're able to be honest and then get help, because I think people are surprised if they say, look, I'm going through this situation and my capacity is not going to be the same and I'll need help. Mm-hmm. Most people are surprised by, okay, how can we help?
Yeah.
And I think then all of a sudden, and then people feel there's a plan in place and it reduces that systemic anxiety, which is going through the organization. And then the third thing is going back to what you talked about as well, is you got to prioritize your own rest and reflection. You know, my mother lived with Alzheimer's for 6 years. Oh. And I remember at the very beginning of the diagnosis, the healthcare nurse came in and she said a statistic that just blew my mind. She said, you know, in 60% of cases, the family caregiver passes before the person living with Alzheimer's. Oh. And it was just a reminder of the strain and the stress and the importance of self-care. So depending on what you're going through, be it a health scare, be it a giver of health care or supporting someone going through a health crisis, divorce, whatever, that to prioritize some rest and reflection, that
Irvin,
these are
can you
moments.
Repeat that? Because that is a stunning.
Yeah. 60% of family caregivers in situations of dementia and Alzheimer's actually pass before the actual person living with the disease itself.
Ooh.
It's incredible. And you know what? As my mother went through that, I could see it. It wasn't just the physical strain. It was the emotional, the mental strain, the stress. And I think at times we underestimate its impact.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so just to kind of like, whoa, if I'm not able to offer myself rest, then, you know, we'll be useless at the end of the day. So it's absolutely important. And then the third thing then I think is more outward facing would be communication becomes really important. And I don't think it has to be this dramatic communication, you know, and I think mm-hmm. most people don't want the drama of this, but this is steady communication, like what I call like gentle communication. You know, I'm still here. I'm still engaged. I'm really grateful for your support and mm-hmm. the situation's ongoing. And most people like, you know, okay, this is a little check-in. It doesn't, again, have to be the adding to the drama, but that communication becomes important because just as you said at the beginning, if there's a gap, people will fill it with stories.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that. And then the other thing is, I think reconnecting to purpose becomes important. Mm-hmm. So just that when we feel drained, I think we have to return to what gives me purpose in life, what gives me purpose in my mm-hmm. my job, because that's energy. That's really good energy. If we can connect to our purpose and connect to yeah. that which lifts us up, so much of what going in a personal crisis is draining. And so we have to as well have something that's lifting us up or re-energizing us. Mm-hmm. I think that's really important as well.
That focusing on purpose to have a anchor
yeah.
right, in an uncertain personal situation.
Absolutely. Yeah. I'm curious, but what would you add? Anything else you would add, some tidbits for people going through this?
Well, you know, I was listening to you when you were talking about gentle communication, and I was recalling somebody that I coached who led a team at a pretty high level in her organization when she got diagnosed with a pretty devastating illness. And she had to leave for 6 months. And so, of course, a plan was put into place for the team to, you know, carry on in her absence. But when she returned 6 months later, after it might have been 9 months after, you know, treatment that was just so difficult, she reached back out to me and said, you know, can we do some coaching sessions? Because I don't know what to communicate and I'm not sure how to re-enter and how much, you know, how much I should say and all that. And so I think one of the things to balance here is to be vulnerable with your team, but to be selectively vulnerable. You don't have to share everything, but you've got to share something. And there's got to be enough transparency to explain your capacity, like you were mentioning. You know, you want to signal, look, I'm human. You know, this has been a struggle here, but I'm here.
Yeah.
And that's what she did. And she wrote a letter to her team. And in it, she shared some of the painful struggles of her treatment, which of course they didn't know about because she'd been out of pocket, and the impact on her family. But then she closed and she said, I'm doing well. I'm so looking forward to getting back to work. And the thing I need from you is, what she said is, what I need from you is to approach me from a place of strength, because I'm ready to partner with you and I'm ready to get back to work. And it's going to be the very best thing for me. I think writing that letter allowed her to set the stage where people could relax. They knew what she had been through, but they knew that she was ready to come back to work and engage, and they could just have confidence in that, right? So be selectively vulnerable.
Yeah.
Right? There's strength in vulnerability. I think the other thing, though, that's important, and she did this, which is she identified two people inside the organization who became her internal support system. And she told them a little bit more about her situation and some of the things that she was still going to be going through and so forth. And they were really there for her and they were backup for her. So I think that's important.
Those two. Well, you know, we always try and ground what we're talking about. And you just gave a beautiful example there of someone you were coaching. But anyone else, a leader perhaps that's well known that you think might show through their actions an embodiment of going through, say, a personal crisis or an event in their lives and leading well through it?
Yeah, you know, when you brought up this topic, I think the example, a famous example that came to mind right away is Sheryl Sandberg. Because, you know, you might recall, right, in 2015, she was COO of Meta. And remember, her husband died unexpectedly.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
And it was shocking. It was not, he wasn't sick. It obviously was a trauma. You know, she had, I think, two youngest children. And needless to say, there was a lot that she had to deal with while she was, you know, leading tens of thousands of employees. So how do you pull that off? And I think what made her leadership through this personal crisis really quite remarkable wasn't her stoicism, it was her honesty. She actually told her team that she was struggling to focus, that she was grieving deeply, and that, quite frankly, she was just learning how to function day by day.
Yeah.
I mean, of course, that would be the case, right?
Yeah.
And so instead of hiding her pain, I think that it took a lot of courage, but she kind of allowed that to be quite visible. And what I think then became so remarkable is that through that honest discourse and that honest sharing, deeper connections were forged and different kinds of conversations were had. Mm-hmm. And she herself became a deeper listener of her own, you know, situation, her own pain and emotions and the emotions of others. And I think her vulnerability kind of sparked some cultural, you know, change there at the company because, you know, after this event, I think Meta expanded like their bereavement leave and some mental health resources and so forth. So it's pretty cool. And, and of course, you know, she was always seen, I think, as a very strong, capable leader. And her way of sharing her pain and her transparency and honesty, I think in the end, people didn't see her as weak for it. They saw her as even more relatable and more trustworthy.
Yeah.
Don't you think that's a really good example?
Yeah, I love that. And I love how that personal experience then enabled her to think a little more globally and to think about, you know, kind of like how do we treat others in the organization that are going through this? And is there anything we can do that would make this experience or at least be more supportive in this experience? So I love the fact how it drove cultural change as well. That's pretty cool.
It really is. I wonder, you know, how many years ago was that? 10 years? I don't know where Sheryl Sandberg is today. Do you?
Yeah, no. I know she's not at Meta anymore. No. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it must be. You know, it's the old thing of happened before COVID or after COVID.
And it's kind
of,
right.
I'm not sure.
Well, wherever she is, I hope that Meta and the culture still has, you know, in its place those things, because that's an incredible legacy, right?
Yeah, totally. Yeah.
Anybody else come to mind for you, Irvin?
You know, I want to bring up another example, because I think what was beautiful about the one you brought up, you know, was an event that was public. So in other words, there was no real hiding what had happened. But sometimes the crisis is a little hidden and at times a little embarrassing. And there was an example I thought of someone I was working with that just did this in a beautiful way. And it was, she was a non-profit CEO. There was two events happening. One was the actual organization was going through a pretty major restructuring and revisioning of itself. And then that in tandem, she was going through a pretty painful divorce. There was children involved. It was messy.
Oof.
And of course, that's a very personal thing.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of language around that. You know, it's, you know, about failure and about everything, you know. And
a lot of judgment.
Yeah. You know, it was interesting because she made a really critical choice as she was going through this. And I remember her saying, you know, I'm not going to pretend. I'm not going to pretend it's not happening. And so she shared really appropriately. And I think she went through a lot of things that you had just spoken about, the vulnerability, but being selective and sharing appropriate. And she did that with her leadership team. And I thought the way she did it, she says, you know, you may see me as a little quieter. You may see my demeanor maybe not the same that it was before. And, you know, she revealed, you know, that she was going through this situation at home and she asked for their partnership. And what was really interesting, you know, I suppose part of the inner language we can say is like, well, if I do that, people are going to think I'm weak or something's wrong or whatever. And really, you know, it was that honesty that really inspired. I remember her saying, you know, I said, the compassion that I've received has been incredible. Mm. And the loyalty from people, you know, stepping up and really increased loyalty towards her. And I think, you know, she talked about, you know, she was able to bring little moments into the workplace, you know, and she said, you know, I was very thankful to people of thank you notes. And sometimes she said, you know, I didn't notice it, but she said it was seeping into some of the reflections that she gave as a leader about pain, et cetera, that was just so relatable to people. And I think it just had an impact on the organization around her. It was such a great model. Now, I think she'd be the first person to say, you know what? It was sloppy at times. I wasn't perfect, but I did my best to be present. And I think, you know, it's a great example that, you know, leading in crisis is not about being unshakable. It's not about being this rock. It's really an opportunity for your humanity to shine and the fact that and a little bit of vulnerability. And just to trust that the grace will fill it, that people are able to show grace in those moments and to let people show grace to you in those moments.
Mm. Gosh, Irvin, I love that example too, because the last thing you said about let people show grace to you, that's a gift to them.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that as leaders, and we've talked about this before, you and I on this podcast, so often we have this pressure that we put on ourselves to be unshakable, to be invincible, to have all the answers, to always look together, to never be without a certain strength that is being projected. And that's just not realistic.
Yeah.
And the other thing is that, you know, life can level any one of us.
Yeah.
It truly can. And I think that when, like, this person you're talking about that you worked with, when she had the courage to say, I'm not going to pretend, and I wasn't perfect, but I was present, I think we have to give ourselves the grace to be just that. We're not going to be perfect. We're not perfect when times are good. We're not going to be perfect in the middle of a personal crisis.
Absolutely, yes.
So yeah, that's what stood out to me most about that example. And I think in the end of the day, all the examples that we've shared are really about people striking that tricky balance of having the courage to be vulnerable, but having the conviction to hang in there and be present through the pain.
Yeah, so true. So true. Well, Bridget, thank you for this conversation today. I think it will resonate with a lot of our listeners. And, you know, if there's just a final thought there, it's, you know, the resilience we're talking about, it's not powering through or pretending that everything is fine. It's actually that groundedness, that honesty with myself and others, and the openness to receive support. And I go back to the very beginning when you talked about, you know, from assistance perspective, that when you help yourself, when you take care of yourself, ironically, that is one of the best things you can do for the people around you, because they will feel that. You know, if you're listening today and you're going through your own hard season, maybe you're dealing with something at the moment, you know, just remember this, you don't have to be flawless. You do not have to be perfect, but you do have to remain connected because it's in those connections that you'll receive the support and others will feel as well the ability to help you. Because I think so often we're surprised at others who want to step up and to really help out in these moments of great personal pain. So thank you for listening, everyone. We look forward to you joining us in the next episode.
Take care, everybody.
Bye now.